So, good morning, everyone. It's good to be back. I don't think I've taught here in probably 6 weeks, 7 weeks. I'm not sure. It seems like a long time, but it's good to be back. And there's a lot going on. As we are here, over in the other building, there's a family program going on. After we end today, there'll be a teen program, a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, and a meeting of members who are working on developing protocols for our community so we can be of benefit and help to members at times of death and dying, so to speak, both for themselves as well as we caretake our loved ones. Is there anybody who is new this morning? So for people who are new, again, we don't give a lot of instruction on Sundays, but we do have classes such as Introduction to Mindfulness. You can see this all on the website that are very good classes for those who want to begin to understand more about the practice of mindfulness and meditation. And on Wednesday nights, we have the meditation is just about mindfulness, and the talks are just about mindfulness. So that's another opportunity for you. So even though I was away in September, I did was in contact with people, and I did hear there were things going on in Florida. So it wasn't as if I was totally in the dark, and having lived in Florida for over 30 years, I know about hurricane season. And I think even though up here in Tampa Bay, this area of Florida, we seem to have been very fortunate in terms of damage. I was in Naples last weekend teaching, community to the south of here, and even though there was not a lot of physical damage to homes for various reasons, even though in some places there were, it was interesting driving down certain areas. Having lived for many years in the Northeast in Rochester and New York, when I was younger in the snow belt, there would be times when there would be, you know, one kind of snowstorm after another. You'd sort of drive down the streets and you'd be in a canyon of snow. You know, there'd be 8-10 foot piles of snow on either side. Those of you who've always lived in Florida, this may sound like some kind of nightmare, but that actually happens. And driving in Naples around certain streets, it was just like that, except these were canyons of brush and trees that had just been piled up on either side of the road, but they were, you know, 8-10 feet high. It was quite something. And we know if we are attending to what the scientists are telling us, we are moving into a time of greater extremities of weather caused by climate change and global warming. And those of us in Florida are certainly going to feel the effects of that more than other places, perhaps, in certain ways. And we also know that for those of us in Tampa Bay, we have the honor, I saw something not too long ago, of being one of the top 10 regions in the world that will be negatively impacted by climate change. Therefore, if we ever needed a Dharma practice, it is now. Because the bubble that we have created in our society of permanence and stability and sort of things continuing the way they always have is certainly may not be the case anymore. We all understand that. And so we need to prepare ourselves. And obviously, there are things in the physical realm that we can do to prepare our homes, et cetera, codes and building codes and just how we create greater stability and things like that. But that's not what I want to talk about this morning. And we have to talk about our minds. And this is the best preparation that each of us can undertake. Again, I think because of the nature of our world as it's developed over the last 100 years, it was not long ago that human beings living in simpler times were much more affected by the instability of weather. Because people depended on crops, you know, all subject to weather, and very easily droughts and too much rain and hail and things like that could very easily totally change things. As well as, I think, just getting around, you know, before the time of cars and planes and trains and everything, just getting around was much more problematic, much more subject to not knowing the outcome. And so I think for much of human history, living with great uncertainty about how things are going to turn out. I mean, health, disease, I mean, things have changed dramatically. I mean, those of us who are younger and have grown up in this our current society may not know that, because we have, clean drinking water, and we have food that is not contaminated, and we have houses, and we have cars. I mean, we have all these things that have created this bubble of sense of dependability and stability, and yet we see, if we are attentive to, what just happened in Houston and what just happened in Puerto Rico, and that this veneer of stability that we are all used to and depend on is actually quite fragile. Right. And as I say, there are, I think, all kinds of good ideas about how this can be dealt with in the material realm. But I want to talk to us about that which is most close to us, which is our own minds and hearts. So I, not having been here for 5 or 6 weeks, I kind of emailed several members who have been here saying, what should I talk about? Would be helpful. And somebody said, my sense is that people are still feeling a bit unsettled by their experiences, open to Dharma lessons to be learned. Somebody else says, fear, fearlessness, three fierce mantras. Taking the practice beyond calming, simply calming afflictive emotions. Taking the practice in life beyond comfort. These are different people. Seeing how our attachments cause us to suffer and freeing ourselves from attachment, finding an inner stability not contingent on outside factors, using difficult situations to break open the shell of selfishness and to open our hearts to the suffering of others. What do you think? I think that could take up maybe a little time this morning. So, it is actually, interesting enough, the impermanence and unpredictability and instability of life that over 2,600 years ago really caused the man who became known over time as the Buddha to begin his spiritual quest, actually. It was this very same situation. It was a little different in his time and in his his little principality up there in northern India, close to Nepal. He was dealing with the same issues because he had grown up in a little bubble of, you know, what passed for privilege at those times. We don't know what it really meant, but he had a very stable life of ease. He was somewhat in what might be called nobility at that time, one of the higher castes. So he had a life of ease, we might say, and he was very protected by his family. So he only knew stability, and he was young, and he was handsome, and he had a lot of energy. And he had just lots of good things in his life. So he had that bubble around him. And he, like many of us, thought it was stable. And it was going to just be that way forever. And again, I think if we look at our own lives, we have to really ask ourselves, even though I know things about change and impermanence, actually, the way I live my life and make my decisions, do I live that way? As if this is just going to go on forever. I mean, that is the good things. The bad things, we're quite happy they don't go on forever. But the good things, we want to go on forever. People, situations, relationships, life, the world. But then for him, he had very personal encounters with sick people, with aging people, and with death. And that, for him, became the decisive kind of existential crisis that made him go, wow, this body of mine, its health, its handsomeness, its beauty, all the things of my life and the people and the things, all of this is impermanent. All of this can disappear in a moment. And we don't, the only thing we don't know is when that moment will be. We hope it'll be, far, far away. But the truth is we don't know, do we? As well as he saw the instability in life. I mean, it was an agricultural society. There were wars. I mean, he just saw the drama of human life and saw how unpredictable and unstable it was. And so this, for him, you know, he didn't increase his alcohol consumption. He didn't take drugs. He didn't go shopping. He didn't devote himself to hedonism and get as much pleasure as he can, knowing that it's, that these are the facts. He began to look deeply. You know, is there anything stable and permanent in this life that a human being can rely on, that is not dependent on this world of change that is so undependable and unstable, including our bodies, right? And again, I won't go into his whole story, but it eventually led to a deep cultivation of an inner meditative life for himself, where he realized the only place that he could look for this kind of stability and clarity and ease within his own mind. Because everything else was dependent on externals, how things were going or not going in life, in his body. And so I think that challenge that the Buddha met, and then from his experiences, from his understandings, that were both meditative understandings, as well as he formulated various truths about life, that he felt that if people really understood and incorporated in their life, they could live in this kind of instable, groundless, where the ground is always shifting world, and be at ease, not be afraid, not be disappointed, not be angry, you know, all those kinds of emotions, but be very clear and present to whatever is going on. So one of, let's, before we begin with the meditative aspect, let's just talk about what's called in Buddhism view. Right? View means, I mean, it means many things, but in Buddhist teaching it's very important. It's like, how do we see things? Do we see things correctly? Do we see things clearly? Do we really see things as they are? Like right now, for example, let's take all these extreme weather things, right? Certain people look at it in one way and come to one conclusion, don't they? And other people over here looking at the same things and they have a totally different conclusion. And we notice in our very polarized society, politically, whatever, that that's the truth, isn't it? You know, sort of, we're all looking at the same situations, but we view them totally differently. And based on how we view them, how we respond to them, etc., how we feel about them, arises. So view, in a certain sense, is everything. Right? And so, in terms of life, to have a clear view, an accurate view, a discerning, intelligent view of the facts is very beneficial. Right? And so one of the major things that the Buddha said, and sort of what I was just talking about, was impermanence. You know, everything is changing. Nothing is stable. At all. The external world is not stable. Our bodies are not stable. They're endlessly changing and subject to change. And our minds, this thing we call our mind, thoughts, feelings, perception, it is constantly changing. Anybody notice that? You all just sat for 30 minutes. What did you notice? Huh? Stable? Same thought the whole time? No, endlessly. And that's just, you know, that's just the way it is. See, that's just the way it is. It's not good. It's not bad. It's not right. It's not wrong. It's not should be, shouldn't be. But it is the way it is. And the more we're able to live in the world as it is, the better able we are to deal with it intelligently, wisely, compassionately. But if we don't understand things clearly, we will distort, right? And many of us distort our own experience because we don't see clearly. Again, in our tradition, we have these things we call the five remembrances that for many people is part of their daily practice. You know, I am, going back to the time of the Buddha, I am of the nature to be sick. It is the whole bodies get sick. I am of the nature to grow old. All bodies age, get sick. I am of the nature to die. I am of the nature to die. This body has the nature to die. Everyone in this room will die. Everybody we know will die. Everybody who's alive in the world right now will die. Is that true? Yes. That's reality. So, we, and there's some other things we that are part of this that we recite every day, and yet, even those who've recited them for 10 and 20 years, still, in the face of their own sicknesses, their own diseases, their own aging, their own stability, and that of the world and the loved ones, still respond with what? Anguish, despair, fear. Anxiety, anger. It shouldn't be this way. And yet, what? It is this way. It's a fact. Right? If we don't embrace the reality of the way things are, we will what? We will suffer. And in Buddhism, all those afflictive emotions that I just talked about, that is called suffering. That's not called normal. See, we think that's normal. But according to the Buddhist teaching, it's not normal because we are reacting with an afflictive emotion to something that is normal. Are you following me? See, that is normal. It doesn't mean when someone we love is sick or has disease, we're not concerned about them. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't mean if somebody we love dies that we don't feel a sadness, but it's no more than that. So this capacity to understand that everything is impermanent, everything is changing, nothing is stable, and that is the way it things, is a profound view. That if you develop this view sort of in your bones, you live by it, it will make your life much more at ease. You'll be free of afflictive emotions. The other view, teaching, again, we're not even getting into meditation yet, right? That the Buddha taught was, you know, karma, or the law of cause and effect. Karma and law are a little different. But basically, it also meant this is not a random universe, right? Or this is not a universe controlled by the gods, right? The impermanence, ever-changing nature of the world, the mind, relationship, is operating according to the law of cause and effect. Everything that has occurred is occurring because of prior causes. Right? It's not just coming out of nowhere. Nothing comes out of nowhere. Right? Something always arises because of preceding causes. Right? Why are we all here today? Well, we could all trace it, even though we all have different lives, we can all trace it back to that. That means sperm and egg, by the way. Yeah, I realize you all might not understand what that means. Right? I mean, that was the physical cause why we're here today. Right? We didn't just come out of nowhere. There were causes. Right? And the kind of bodies we have and the kind of minds we have is also the product of causes. Right? We don't have our body. We have our ancestors' body. We have our parents' body. Nobody in here chose their body. Is that clear? Right? When you look in the mirror, you're looking at your ancestors. You're looking at your parents. You're not looking at you. Right? And even this body that we inherited from our parents is a product of their parents and their parents. You know what I'm saying? It's many, many causes and conditions created this body. As well as we have had many experiences in life, each of us. All kinds of experiences, constantly having experiences, right, from birth. This also has conditioned us to be the way we are. We think we're here as kind of self-actualized, this is me, right? This is the way I think, and this is the way I feel, and these are my ideas, and these are my values, and this is my belief. Do you know what I'm talking about? See, we all kind of feel that, like that's... And some of us are very proud of them, and some of us are not proud of them. But the truth is, where did we get it all from? The causes and conditions of our lives. Right? We think we're so much better than other people who have these kinds of ideas. But if we were brought up in that family and had all the same life experience that they had, we'd be like them. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote that great poem, Call Me By My True Name, where he said, this is during the time of the boat people fleeing Vietnam, he said, I am that young girl who is raped by the pirate. And I am the pirate. Raised the way I was raised and know no difference. Right? I am, you know, I am the frog and I am the bug. This, for many of us, is hard to accept, but it is the truth. And so, again, if the way the world is, it's constantly disturbing to us, constantly causing us to despair, or causing us to be angry, or causing us always to have an unsettled mind, or causing us to be afraid. You see what I'm saying? It is because why? It's because we cannot accept that things are the way they are because of causes and conditions. Why do we have global warming? Causes and conditions. So lots of causes and conditions. Why do people get sick? Why do they have disease? Causes and conditions. Why does this happen? Why does that happen? Causes and conditions. Why do we have the political situation in our country now? Causes and conditions. It didn't come out of nowhere. Nothing comes out of nothing. Something comes out of something. Right? And when we understand that, we can get on with life. But many of us cannot get on in life because our response to life is always one of resistance, always one of emotional affliction, always one of attachment aversion. We are constantly keeping ourselves in an emotional turmoil. No wonder we have the problems in the world we have. There's very little clear thinking, clear perception. Right. So view, the way we view what's going on in life, and I'm not even talking about, you know, crossing our legs and meditating yet, right? So if you think that mindfulness and meditation is the panacea you've been waiting for, it's not. It's definitely part of, but it's not. So seeing clearly is also, in the, you know, very essential, and that is why we study these teachings that have been, fortunately, you know, in this dark age where wisdom and intelligence and real compassion seems to be so lacking. So many areas of our world, we are fortunate that there are these ancient traditions that have incredible wisdom, that there are these thousands and tens of thousands and millions of men and women over thousands of years who have looked deeply into life in the same situations that we're dealing with and have come up through their own direct experience with very meaningful, accessible, and practical ways of dealing with life. And again, it's very interesting to me, as I said earlier, that 2,600 years ago, the Buddhist time was obviously such a different time, and yet there was all this instability, and yet we may be very much entering, as we see, a new era of great instability, not only in the weather, but in human beings and life and societies. So in a world like this, where do we take refuge, you see? Where do we find a safe harbor? Well, you know, one way is to close off, right? Make sure that we're taken care of, you know. Close off, close down, hunker down. That's one response. But again, that's predicated on the on the belief that somehow that can be maintained. And that that way of living is a way, while it may produce some sense of safety, physical safety and security, it may not be emotionally, mentally, you know, a meaningful way to live. So, if we are not going to find ease of mind, peace of mind, stability of mind, wisdom, intelligence, compassion, etc., based on things that are going on externally, we need to turn inwardly, which is fine, because all these states that we seek are states of mind, right? So when we talk about peace of mind, open-heartedness, compassionate mind, wise mind, fearless mind, right? We're talking about what? Mind. Is that clear? Everything. We're talking about states of mind. Where do these states of mind arise? Within our own mind. Right? Nowhere else. So therefore, it behooves us to not only have a clear view of life, so we can deal with it intelligently and clearly and wisely, but we need to have a mind that has the capacity of supporting intelligence and wisdom and compassion in the world. Right? Which means a mind that is free of afflictive emotions. Anybody here ever been angry? Okay? A lot of clear thinking when you're angry? Anybody here ever been very anxious and worried about something? A lot of clear thinking and wise decision making around that? Right? Anybody ever here really been sad and despairing and about life? I mean, is that a good support to you know, to going forward in life in a healthy way? No. We have to finally, you know, Shantideva, this great 8th century Indian Buddhist master said, he said, you know, our problem is, and this is on a chapter he's writing about patience. He says, the problem is we are patient with the wrong things. We are patient with our afflictions. We will just tolerate them forever. I mean, it's very interesting. He really calls us on it, you know. He says, you know, we are so incredibly patient with our delusions, with our afflictive mind states, with our obsessive mind states. You know, we'll work with them forever. Right? I mean, he said, you know, guys, well, it's me talking, he didn't talk this way. He basically said, you know, we need to become impatient and less tolerant of these afflictive mind states that cause unhappiness and suffering to ourselves and to our loved ones, and eventually society. If we're going to be impatient, let's be impatient with those things. So, if the source of our emotional ill-being or well-being, our peace of mind or our stressed out, distracted nature of mind, or whatever you want to call it, lies within the mind, what's the technology for beginning to become aware of what's going on in our mind, see the causes of our emotional distress? You know, what's the technology that allows us to understand, to see, to view, and then transform? And that's why in Buddhism, the centrality of the meditative path. Okay? It's not like, you know, the Buddha looked around and said, well, what would be a good practice that I could give my followers, you know? So many different kinds out there, you know, there's devotion. I mean, you know, he grew up in a religious society. There's devotion, there's worship, there's, you know, good deeds. There's all kinds of paths, you know, and more so that are open to, you know, to people who want to, you know, lead a good life, a religious life, spiritual life. But again, because he was so focused on transformation, he said, it's the mind and the technology that unlocks the secrets of the mind is meditation. There is no other way. Again, we know in our society, we have found other ways, haven't we? Pharmacology, legal and illegal. You know, massive use of pharmaceuticals, legal and illegal, right? To what? To what? Change and alter, to help us cope, and to somehow kind of, you know, make us feel better or be able to deal with the difficulties of life, right? So there is a whole world of, you know, those kinds of things, as well as there is a world of endless stimulation that is provided to us by electronics, by our technology, by our entertainment world, that will endlessly give us very short-term distractions and moments of pleasure, happiness, as well as all the activities. Going on vacation. I think it's better than that. And yet, unfortunately, all these solutions that we try are only short-term. They only last as long, right? As the experience lasts, the substance lasts, and then we're back to the same place. So why don't we deal with that place? You see, that is so uncomfortable to us that we don't want to deal with. Why don't we learn to deal with it and transform it? So our minds become a place that we are happily dwelling in. Peacefully dwelling in. I mean, doesn't that seem kind of like a simple solution to the problem? Rather than all this other kinds of activity that we're constantly having to run around, right? To solve our essential problem, that we are not at ease here. We don't feel whole here. We don't know how to cope with what arises here in our own minds, in our own bodies. We don't know how to take care of ourselves. We don't take care of our bodies. We don't take care of our minds. So why don't we just learn that? The same way many of us here, you know, we learned a profession, right? We devoted time to education and training. We learned a craft. We learned a hobby, we learn to play an instrument. I mean, there are many things that we have learned because we were willing to put ourselves through a course of training and discipline and study that have benefited to us. Everybody know what I'm talking about? You know, that's, we understand that, right? And yet, when it comes to that which is most essential, because whatever our profession is, whatever our career is, whatever we're doing, that still doesn't obviate the fact that there's a me who's doing all that. And how am I? How is that person who is doing that? How is that person in relationship? Am I well? Am I at peace? Am I happy? Am I in life open-heartedly, compassionately, wisely? Is that how I'm showing up in life? Or not? And if not, it's not like, you know, you gotta go, I'm a bad person. I mean, see, we love to do that stuff, right? I mean, that's kind of our game, you see. Everything's always about me, right? If I'm not a great person, then I'm a terrible person. And then I dwell on that. Earlier on, we talked about to liberate ourselves from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and it's like, you know, we just, you know, some people love the superiority complex. I'm better than everybody, and they carry that one around. That's called arrogance. Other people like it the other side of life. I'm deficient. I'm less than. Everyone's better than me. You know. You know what I mean? We. But it's the same thing. Distortions. We're distorting. And in Buddhism, this over-reliance and identification with self and me is considered one of the prime distortions. We're not going to go into that today, but that's also has to do with view and then eventually realization. We do see ourselves as a separate self, separate and distinct from everyone else, from society, the planet, climate, you know what I mean? You know, and that's part of the problem. I mean, these are not just deep spiritual and philosophical issues, which they are, but we see it acts out, right? We live in a world where nobody feels connected, or many people don't feel connected to one another. They don't realize we're in this together. And we don't feel connected to our planet, to our earth. Right? And that somehow, you know, there's a deep interrelationship between human beings, animals, plants, minerals. You know, there's a harmony. And that somehow we need to really understand that harmony and the laws that sustain it in a sustainable way. Or we're going to what? We're going to destroy ourselves. You know, most animals do not defecate in their nests. We all know that, right? I mean, animals know that. But human beings don't know that because we will, you know, defecate all over this wonderful planet of ours, don't we? And because we forget that we live here, right? That the seas nurture us, that the earth nurtures us. But you see, because of our alienation and separation, we think, everybody thinks, I can just do my little separate thing over here and doesn't have any big effects, does it? The trouble is when you have 6 billion people doing that, it has a lot of effects. So even these historical, you know, issues of self and non-self and interconnection and interrelationship and oneness that seem to be more in ancient times a purview of mystics and spiritual acolytes and everything, I think today is like front and center for the whole society. Because if we don't begin to operate in this world on a radically different set of principles, well, we understand what's going to happen. So in a certain way, for individuals, we know that for many individuals, oftentimes, our spiritual life, or beginning to look more deeply into life, you know, many people, unfortunately, most people, do not kind of undertake a spiritual life or deeper questioning, you know, because everything's wonderful, right? Usually when everything's wonderful, we're what? Don't want to rock the boat here. You know, it's usually when we are either going through a difficult time or others are going through a difficult time, or we're kind of looking at life in a deeper way, you know, that's what often motivates us to look more deeply into our life and to think about maybe I need to live differently. Right? I mean, does everybody know what I'm talking about? There are probably many of you here. I mean, why you get us, you know, why am I here? You know, why on a Sunday morning, you know, aren't I at the beach? Maybe some of you are asking yourself. you know, how come I'm not at the beach? Or how come I'm not out having brunch? You know, it's brunch time, right? You know, what are we doing here? Well, I would imagine for many of us, we're all unique. It's because something in our life is causing us to look for different solutions, right, than we've always looked to. Or we've decided that the solutions we've always used don't really produce the effects that they promised or thought. So in the same way, as individuals, even in times of personal extremity, have the opportunity and are often called to really look more deeply into life and to chart different paths in life, that is the great hope for our times, right? That the extremity of our social situation, political situation, climate situation, will wake people up. And we see what's going on in society, isn't it? Whole sectors of society are waking up and saying, there's something fundamentally wrong here, right? And other sectors of society are saying, no, everything's right. We just got to do it more. What's right? Right? And so you see this response so radically different. And that's a lot of the underlying tension that's going on in our world. And those of us who are older need to really become more responsible to the younger generations, to give them a vision of life, both personal and societal, that has greater value and meaning. Why don't we stop now? The kids are coming in about 15 minutes. So any questions? I mean, just stop a second and just think. This is not a sermon. I'm not up here preaching anything. I'm just sharing what's called the Dharma and talking about how we can use this Dharma, these ancient teachings and practices, to give meaning to our personal lives and societal lives. But maybe there are things about what I've said are not that understandable, or you're not clear how that relates to you, or anyhow, I'm open to any question you have, or criticism. Yes. Your name is what?
Amanda.
And just, this is being live streamed, so if I repeat things, so they can hear. So this is Amanda.
A lot of times I pause when I'm trying to say very thoughtful, and it seems like the thought is coming out of my mouth, and
So that's a comment. You don't have a question. Yeah, so that's good. I mean, obviously, So Amanda was just sharing that she has found just when she's in a state of either confusion or she kind of has a sense that she's going down the wrong road, she just stops. She pauses. And in that space, either she can find that right way within herself, or she gets the opportunity of asking her mentors or people she respects about what to do. Yeah, essential. You know, that's essential. That's the beginning of a spiritual path. You know, we may not be all fully enlightened Buddhas, we may not be deeply steeped in the practices of the teachings, right? As most of us aren't, but we can learn to identify all those wrong roads that we have been taking. Right? All of us have that introspective capacity to look into our lives and see, yeah, when I do this, this, and this, good things happen. And when I do this, this, and this, not so good things happen. or really bad things happen. You know, that's a unique quality of this human mind. It's a wonderful quality. We have this quality for self-introspection, self-analysis, and we need to use it. And again, we don't have to be fully enlightened deep meditators to do it. Just kind of watch your mind, watch your behavior, watch the world, and you'll see, right? Certain kinds of ways of thinking, feeling, speaking, acting, cause, lead to suffering for myself or others. There's another whole bunch over here that either don't, maybe those are neutral, or create positive, wholesome outcomes, right? So, if you're like Amanda and says, well, I'm beginning to see that, but I still, again, all of us are propelled by our karma, right? We have within us the impressions, the seeds of our past. Just because we've read a Buddhist book or we've gone to a Buddhist talk, it doesn't mean that stuff's not going to still be propelling us. If you think that's going to happen, you're going to be deeply disappointed. The seeds of our past actions of body, speech, and mind lie deep within our consciousness. And they will continue to come up. But as Amanda wisely pointed out, we can at least begin to kind of know the wholesome from the unwholesome, the positive from the negative. And we can at least begin to exert some self-control. Right? Stopping, pausing, giving space. When I was a therapist, I used to call that duct tape therapy. You know? I know you want to say it to her, and I know you want to say it to him, but every time you've done it that way in the past, what is the outcome? Right? I mean, everybody know what I'm talking about. You know it. So, you know, if you don't know any better, at least duct tape it. You know, that is at least stopping this pattern of suffering that we just participate in and that we are patient in. So pausing, stopping, you know, to acknowledge. I mean, we may not know yet the right way of communicating, okay? But we can at least begin with knowing, I know the wrong way of communicating, and I'm not going to do it anymore. Right? That's like people who go into recovery, right? They don't know yet how to live a wholesome life, do they? No, they don't have a clue, because all they know is unwholesomeness. But they do know that if they continue drinking and drugging, it's only going to be more suffering, right? So stop. It's the same wisdom. And then you walk your spiritual path, and in times you will develop that capacity. So thank you. Stopping, pausing. Very important. We gotta change this karma. Yes. You don't, eh? Oh. Yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah. So this is the question is in relation to something I said about older people really beginning to help younger people, you know, in their lives, and so the question was, but how do we do it in a way that's meaningful? That they will accept. I mean, if we just proselytize or just lay it on them, that usually turns people off. So, yeah, so this is another whole Dharma talk, which is about what we call appropriateness and skillfulness of a compassionate response. So, we may look around the world and see all kinds of people suffering, right? But many of them, you know, don't know they're suffering. I mean, if you went to our dear president and said, "Wow, you really suffer in life," I mean, he'd look at you like you were what? Nuts. He thinks, doesn't get any better than this. So I'm just using that as an extreme example. So again, you know, any intervention we do with anybody to be of help should always be appropriate to the person in the situation, right? And also be skillful. And obviously one of the first things in terms of any intervention we do with anybody are they open? You know, do they want to hear it, right? And if they don't want to hear it, don't waste your breath. Because not only will it not be of help to them, but they might even get a little irritated at you or resist you because you're always so, yeah. I mean, I think the first thing you said was really most important, and you sort of just said it, well, we can always, you know, I can always change myself. No, that is the most important to begin. We can always begin with ourselves. Thich Nhat Hanh says, you want a peaceful world, become a peaceful person. You want a nonviolent world, become a nonviolent person. That we can begin right now. You know, we can have great, wonderful, utopian ideals for the world, but how do we know they can be implemented? Right? How do we know that people can really be kind, be compassionate, be loving, act intelligently, have peaceful minds, right? Isn't that, I mean, how else do you create a peaceful world if you don't have peaceful people? I mean, angry, violent people are not going to create a violent world, I mean, a peaceful world, right? Because if violence and aggression can create a peaceful world, after the 20th century, right, we should be living in a time of absolute peace, right? But we don't. Why is that? Because things only arise from causes and conditions. A peaceful world can only be created by peaceful people. A loving world where people care about one another can only come out of the human beings who are that way. So to me that is most important. And all of us can begin, right? Take our ideals, take our values, and live them. Not just only on the public stage, but in your life, in your relationships, family, home, work, society, right? Become that person. Become a peaceful person. Become a compassionate person. So to me, that's the best example we can give our children, is how we conduct our life. And we need to be respectful. You know, if there's any one major thing that is going on in our bigger society today, is the absolute lack of respect that people have for people who have other views than them. Right? It's a deep sickness in our society, on all sides. You know, so learning to respect other human beings, even if they have the most noxious ideas, if we want to create a society where people respect the value of human life and of human beings, then we have to begin that way. And it's easy to, you know, to do it for people that we agree with. You know, we don't get any credit for that. The challenge is, can I be respectful and open to people who have different views than me, who have different ideas than me? See, that's the challenge. That's what makes us a bigger person. So you know, I think it's very important that we, you know, begin with ourselves, become the best person we can be. Right? And then I think people begin to see that. Some days your children may be curious about you as they see you transformed. And someday they may come to you and say, you know, this Buddhist thing that you seem to be in, you want to tell that to me? Right? You know what I'm saying? Or something like that. Or, you know, meditation. What is this meditation? I was reading, you know, like that. Any other questions? Yes.
One of the things that I'm struggling with a little bit, or just looking for clarity, is the question about dealing with emotions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sort of a negative connotation, but being human is all about experiencing emotions, both positive, passion, and negative ones. So just to clarify, is it really not so much to neutralize or suppress them, but really more about how we become more skillful in dealing with them and not become attached to our emotions?
Yeah, so that's another whole Dharma talk, and I think I have about a minute. So let me just say simply, the question was about emotions, and aren't all emotions human, and aren't we just supposed to be okay with our emotions and not repress or suppress? Well, that's an interesting, is that really, see what I'm trying to say is, I think that's a good place to begin. You know, we begin with, this is who we are, and if I look in my mind, I have good things, bad things, afflictive things, peaceful things, right? I think it's a good place. It's kind of a neutral, accepting place. But at the same time, there has to be some wisdom to go, yeah, anger and rage and resentment and hurt and disappointment and fear, these harm me. And they harm my relationships with other people. So Buddhist psychology, which is a very profound psychology, not just goes emotions, they talk about wholesome emotions and unwholesome emotions. Not just based on, you know, like somebody making a choice. You know, it's not a moral choice or an ethical choice. It's about what causes suffering and what causes goodness. And so, again, you know, I think emotionally there's a developmental path. You know, I think where you said is a good beginning. So we get out of this disliking ourselves, you know what I mean? But once we begin to see the full plate, then the process of transformation begins. So it's developmental. Does that make sense? And for many of us who've always suppressed and repressed, you know, we got to get over that one.